Paul, have you got your contacts in? You're looking slightly, you know.
No, I'm looking out the window because it's more interesting than looking at you two.
Yeah. Or not Paddy, who seems to be cooking his breakfast in the background.
Hello, everyone. This is Colin Schindler, along with John Holmes and Patrick Barclay, welcoming you back to another edition of Football Ruin My Life. And this week, we're going to be talking about those big lads with heads squashed flat and brains curdled into early onset dementia by the constant heading of old-fashioned leather footballs that weighed the same as a cannonball after it had been soaked by rain and coated in mud. And because we're all a certain age, I'm talking about centre-halves, not central defenders, though no doubt we'll get to them in due course. Centre-halves were the bulwark of any defence. The position essentially started, I think, by Herbert Chapman, who withdrew the centre of the three halfbacks from the midfield to play between the two fullbacks. Now, Paddy, you've written a book about Chapman. What was his thinking about this at the time?
Well, he was guided by fashion, actually. Although it is always associated with him, there was definitely a third centre back, before Chapman. It was suggested to him after a heavy defeat up in the northeast by Charlie Buchan, his new signing, that you've got to do something about this defence or we're going to have to score 7 to win any game. So he was persuaded into it. Up until then, centre-backs typically had been creative players, pivots like Guardiola or, you know, the holding midfield player, basically. They saw a lot of the ball and they had to be able to pass. Putting them in the middle meant that their duties were largely defensive. And it did have an effect on the game. I'm trying to remember the name of Chapman's first, but he was no good at it because he was a creative player. So Chapman had to go out and buy, what's his name? Oh, it's ridiculous.
Was this at Huddersfield or at Arsenal?
At Arsenal.
At Huddersfield, he played conventionally an old-fashioned.
No, actually, you're quite right. They played a cup final. Their first trophy, they played a guy called Tom Wilson in that position, and it was successful. But it became, you know, universal after he signed a guy from Oswestry.
Where's your team of researchers, Paddy?
Well, exactly. I had to let myself go due to economic factors. But the I did come away with a good package. Oh, anyway, he was booed on every away ground for being unsportsmanlike enough to want the ball more than the opposing centre.
Well, I think Hapgood was a left-back, wasn't he?
Yeah, I could probably go through the rest of the team, but I can't remember this centre-half. But anyway, from that time on, from Chapman's success with the system then, the only people who weren't let into the secret that you played three at the back were programme editors who always, right up to, 1960s, would list teams in 2-3-5 formation, which didn't exist. There's no such thing as 2-3-5. Chapman played with a 3-4-3, the same game as played now, 3-4-3, simple as that.
Withdrawn inside forwards, are you saying?
Yeah.
Actually, the same system as the guys playing at Leicester at the moment. We calls it an inverted fullback or something,
yes.
As if it was something new. And the inside forwards are the inside forwards now. It's almost like it's gone back full circle. And my Charlie Spencer at centre-half.
No, it
wasn't. Oh, no, Newcastle beat them, sorry.
He played centre-half in that game where they were beaten heavily up in the northeast. And Charlie Buchan had come from the northeast. He still had a sports shop there. And so he was so furious that he said to Chapman, you've got to do something about our defence. That was it. The centre-half I'm still searching for, but
Herbie Roberts,
I remember.
Herbie Roberts, not a particularly big man, but a sort of Nobby Styles who, although he could play, he was quite happy not to let others play. So he was good from that point of view. But that was the foundation of modern defence and the beginning of centre-halves. They continued to be called centre-halves. A friend of mine called Leo Moynihan wrote a book about centre-halves a couple of years ago called They Shall Not Pass. And yet he was using, we're talking about centre-halves, but they're not. They're centre-backs and have been for nearly 100 years.
They weren't always necessarily big. Let's not forget the England captain for many years after World War II, Billy Wright. Billy Wright was a centre-back, was not a big man.
Yeah, 5'8". The World Player of the Year in 2006, was 2007 maybe, Fabio Cannavaro, a great, but again, not large, defender.
Billy Wright started as a wing half, though, which is what his build would suggest.
He started as a winger during the war. He played for Leicester in those wartime games as a left winger, I believe.
But for Wolves and for England in the immediate post-war era, Wright was the right half.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, it must have been after the Hungary game because he was certainly a wing half there going to the wrong fire. Because Harry Johnston of Blackpool was the centre-half in that game at Wembley. Yeah. So it must have been after that that Wright transferred to the middle of defence. And that, I assume, was Walter Winterbottom's idea, probably.
Billy Wright, I suppose, was a footballing centre-back, although I didn't see enough of him. But the most famous England captain of all, Bobby Moore, wasn't a big man. I mean, he was average height, no more.
Yeah, but my point is that he wasn't the centre-half.
No.
That was Brian Lebone or it was Jack Charlton, and he played alongside him.
The centre-half, you know, when I think of those, I think of, you remember Oxford had a great team in the Maxwell days? I think of Shotton and Briggs. My God, you wouldn't argue with those two. They fitted your description early, but not many do. I mean, you look at the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of footballing centre-backs then, much more than there are today, despite the cliched view that we have a much more technical game today. I'm thinking immediately of Colin Todd. I'm thinking of Roy McFarland. And although a great Sunderland and Man City and England centre-half, Dave Watson, the first Dave Watson, although he was a big man who could head balls away and tackle you, he was also a footballer.
Yeah. I've written down a list of England centre-halves.
Mm.
And the first one that came to mind after Herbie Roberts, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, if he was Arsenal and it only happened in the 30s, then it was happened very quickly that Wolves produced Stan Cullis, who was the classic centre-half.
Mm-hmm.
And he was certainly around from the mid-30s onwards as a centre-half. Then after the war, you got Neil Franklin, and that was a change because that was a...
He could play.
He could certainly play. He could play in Bogota.
That's the trouble. He played outside FIFA's system. Witnesses have been queuing up all my life to tell me what a wonderful footballer Neil Franklin was. Although, of course, he defected from Stoke City, I think it was, to the ill-fated, short-lived breakaway league in Colombia.
Stan Cullis was what we now regard as an old-fashioned centre-half because... I take your point, Paddy, they weren't all towering figures. But at the same time, they were having to mark those old-fashioned centre-half battering rams.
Yes,
so they needed quite a physical presence
definitely
to be able to stand up to that, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely they did. But as you say, they didn't have to be big, but they had to be strong. Cullis was very, very strong. Again, I didn't see him play in the flesh, but it wasn't that he couldn't play, but he realised he had to win the physical battle before anything else could be contemplated. And they were big men, those centre-forwards. Strong and ruthless.
John, I'm waiting for a litany or a long list of Leicester City centre-halves who were absolutely outstanding and were unluckily never capped by England.
Well, I tell you what, there was a player called Jack Froggatt who played left wing for Portsmouth when they won the league and later came to Leicester and was converted back to playing centre-half. So that's an interesting journey. As I say, Billy Wright also. I've got a programme that I've seen from a wartime match with Billy Wright playing for Leicester against Arsenal with Leslie Compton at centre-forward for Arsenal and Dennis Compton on the left wing. Leslie Compton went back from being a centre-forward. So notable centre-forwards and centre-backs have exchanged, haven't they? Martin O'Neill was greatly in favour of this system. He played a fellow called Steve Walsh, who was a centre-back through and through, but he played him up front. Magnificent header of the ball, Steve Walsh. And he scored the goal that won a playoff game and was frequently employed as a centre-forward, as was Matt Elliott on occasions as well.
And Michael Parkinson's favourite ever footballer, John Charles, who was outstanding in both positions as well. So, yes, I do understand that there is an interchange between the two. But when you talked about Froggatt, I mean, it immediately brought into mind the most remarkable central defender, I suppose you'd have to say, the man who played alongside the centre-half. Because classically, Larry Lloyd was an old-fashioned centre-half.
Yes.
And the man who played alongside him, Kenny Burns, had been, what was he, sort of small forward at Birmingham City.
He played centre-forward, Kenny Burns. He had occasionally played at the back. But when he came to Forest, he played all the time at the back and became extraordinarily successful. They were a great partnership, weren't they? with Larry Lloyd and with David Needham, who also played for Forest, who was also a genuine centre-back. He never played up front.
Well, I do think of centre-halves in a particular physical capacity. I mean, I'm thinking of Peter Swan. After Billy Wright, Peter Swan was one of the early English centre. And then it was Jack Charlton.
Yes.
And then it was Brian Le Bon. And they are absolutely of a certain kind. A moment to ask Paddy, because Peter Swan was part of his favourite England team. What are your memories of Peter Swan, centre-half?
Very tall and commanding, definitely. But once again, he could play a little. He, of course, ended his career in disgrace in the betting scandal that we've referred to in previous episodes of this podcast. That's not to detract from what an exceptional player he was. I put him in the same bracket as Maurice Norman from the Spurs double team. You know, he did have this height, so he didn't have to worry about that. He might well, I'm not sure if I've got the time frame right, but I think he would have been a candidate for the 1966 World Cup squad.
Oh, yes, yes.
Ahead of Jack Charlton, who, of course, turned out to be a great centre-half.
Also, sort of Scottish legend, this fellow George Young.
Oh, yes.
He was very strong, but he wasn't particularly tall, was he? The Rangers and Scotland centre-back.
No, he wasn't tall. He made his debut at the age of 59, going on 22. He looked like he should have been the referee or the chairman of the board. I don't think he had a youth. I think he sort of popped out with a lovely head of silver hair. And what the midwives must have thought, I don't know. But he was good for Rangers. And they later had a centre-half called Ron McKinnon. There was one before that called Davy Meiklejohn. Terry Butcher always tells the story of when he played for Rangers and immediately became a fan's favourite because he, I suppose, Colin, he would be the archetypal centre-half, you know, heart on the sleeve, would head his granny over the touchline to stave off a counter-attack. He told me that early in his career at Rangers, a legend of a journalist called Jim Roger, the Jolly they used to call him. We could do a whole episode on Jim Roger, trust me. And Jim Roger came up to him and said, hey, son, pulled him by the lapels and says, you can be mentioned in the same bracket as Davy Meiklejohn. And of course, Butch had never heard of Davy Meiklejohn. And he had to go and look him up. But we're digressing into Scottish football here.
No, it's fine because, you know, I keep thinking of Gordon McQueen.
Yes.
Classically. But I want to ask John about Bobby Charlton's brother, because he wasn't the greatest player, self-admitted never the greatest player. But really, it's hard to think of anybody else who fitted in better to Alf's plan when he won the World Cup in 1966. I mean, Jack Charlton was an outstanding centre-half.
It's true. He was a late arrival, wasn't he? He played the majority of his career in the second division for Leeds until Revie arrived. And I think it's fair to say Jack wasn't a particularly committed professional at that stage. Revie seemed to transform Jack Charlton more than any other player. I suppose he'd played second fiddle to John Charles a lot of the time. I think he'd occasionally gone up front as well. But then Revie obviously decided he was the centre-back, paired him with the fearsome Norman Bites Your Legs Hunter. And they became the most feared and successful centre-back partnership, as it were. We then got to the era of centre-back partnerships, didn't we?
Yeah.
You know, we do mention Charlton and Hunter together. We mention Moore and Charlton for England together.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of others.
I'll give you a great one. One of them's a Hunter. Hunter and Beattie at Ipswich.
Correct.
Now, Beattie, what a footballer.
Yeah.
Now, everybody who can play and is also physically a great big sack of muscle, if they're any good, they get, is this the new Duncan Edwards?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, it didn't sound so daft when applied to Kevin Beattie, because he could bring the ball out of defence, drop a shoulder, beat a man, and then hit a diagonal. He was a fantastic player in Bobby Robson's outstanding Ipswich side. Alan Hunter was a Northern Irish, good centre-half, very seldom would make a mistake, and they dovetailed beautifully. And that was the key, as in Hunter, because Hunter could play. Hunter could really play, although he loved this bites your legs rubbish, but he could play. And so could Jack a little bit, by the way, Jack Charlton. He was a much better player than he looked, if you see what I mean.
Russell Osman and Terry Butcher.
Osman and Butcher. Look at that. He had two great partnerships, and that's just at Ipswich, you know?
Yes. The other fellow we haven't mentioned about the big centre-backs who really personified and came to the fore in that era and was a key component in Liverpool's rise was Ron Yates.
Of course.
You know, the Shankly quite. He signed Ron Yates and he signed Ian St. John and famously got the press there and said, "This is my centre half, Ron Yates, take a walk around him." Yeah. And he's so big, we could play Arthur-esque in goal.
Ron Yates eventually was paired. I think Willie Stevenson probably helped him out a bit.
Tommy Smith.
Yeah, but then Shankly, maybe with Paisley's influence, hit on this brilliant idea of having his second centre-half as a midfield player, which Tommy Smith was.
Yes.
And again, Tommy Smith liked to pretend he was a killer and all that.
Yep. Pretend? You're saying he wasn't really?
Well, he was a bit naughty, but not as bad as he liked to make out. He liked the pantomime. And he was fearsome to look at, you know, with these Charles Bronson pockmarked skin, and he wasn't an easy smiler, but actually a very nice chap. But the combination of the massive Ron Yeats and the rather smaller but more constructive midfield player.
Well, that's how it seemed to be that it worked best, with the old-fashioned tower block in the middle and the much more mobile number six working around him, as in Charlton and Moore.
But Paisley was a purist and eventually ended up with two footballers at centre-half in Anson and Laurenson. But Laurenson could tackle any centre-forward with any sense, would jump out of the way if Mark Laurenson came in with one of those torpedo-style tackles that he did. So even at Liverpool, you can see an evolution of centre-half.
There was also the experiment Matt Gillis employed at Leicester with this revolving centre-back, in that he played a fellow called John Schoberg at centre-back, or Ian King. Yes. And then he employed Graham Cross, Colin Appleton, or Frank McClintock, who later became the centre-back at Arsenal.
And won the double.
Yeah, when they won the double. They shuttled between, it was a revolving system, which was notably successful against Liverpool over a period of time.
Mm. I'm looking at my list of players, and as we move towards the modern era, we quite clearly start losing the giants who can't play, because even those who are of a decent build, like, I don't know, Sol Campbell and, well, Des Walker. Now, Des Walker's not got the physique of a classic centre-half, but he was a terrific central defender.
Terrific pace.
Because of his speed, wasn't it?
All pace with Des. Yes. Because when Sampdoria tried to get him to play out of defence, it didn't work. But phenomenal pace. And the other very, very quick, small centre-half of those times, a wonderful, wonderful player, Kevin Ratcliffe, up at Everton, who was one of the four great players in the Welsh team, along with Giggs, Hughes,
Southall,
and Neville Southall, the best goalkeeper I ever saw play in Britain.
John, the best centre-half who ever played for Leicester City was...
You would say the one who has the legendary status is Steve Walsh. Although he played a lot of his career in the second division for Leicester, he had a sort of cult hero status in that he would go up front and score goals, scored the goal in a playoff final to get us into the Premier League at one stage. And there was a magnificent game at Leicester where Bergkamp scored a hat-trick, and then Walsh went up. In those days, they didn't pay that much injury time. It was before they indicated, but went up in the sixth or seventh minute and scored an equaliser with an absolutely stunning header. He was a centre-back who could attack the ball from a corner. Very few centre-backs I know attack the ball like Steve Walsh did. He was amazing. Matt Elliott was also a very, very fine centre-back. So you would have to call them the best, although when we won the league, of course, there's then Robert Huth and Wes Morgan.
Yeah, absolutely. Colin, do you mind if I ask you a couple of Man City questions? One,
not at all.
Who's the best centre-half you ever saw play a home match at Main Road? And two, who's the best centre-half you ever saw play a home match at any Manchester City ground in any era?
Well, I think, to be honest, the first one said somebody we've already mentioned, which was Dave Watson.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think of a better centre-half. I mean, all-round centre-half.
No.
He wasn't with us for that long, only 3 or 4 years at most. Mm. But at that time, I just felt this is the man who really belongs here.
And has Vinny Kompany was...
A fine player, different kind of a player, clearly. Not that dominant. I mean, he was a difficult bloke to get past. And, of course, he had an unfortunate injury record. Kompany was forever getting injured, which was a great shame because they were better side when he played than when he didn't. And he was also one of those few players of the modern era. I mean, his dedication to the club was such that he seemed to belong to an earlier era, and I respected him enormously for that. I was very fond of company.
Were Oakes, Doyle, centre-backs?
Well, Doyle was converted from a right half to a joint centre-half with Watson, and they played together very successfully in the mid-1970s until they went to Wembley for a match that you saw, John, where Holland took them apart at the seams, and Doyle and Watson were the twin centre-halves, who, and we lost 2-0, but it could have been 10.
Oh, they were, because Mike Doyle, again, a convert from midfield, just wasn't quite of the class to cope at that level. But Alan Oakes, though, John also asked about him. I don't remember him ever playing centre-half.
No, well, he was absolutely an old-fashioned defensive left-half.
Yeah, yeah.
He only had one foot. He wasn't great in the air, but he was the most... I mean, I think he still holds the record for the most appearances at City. I mean, 659, something like that. I don't think anybody's played more often for City. He was there from 1959 to 1977.
Yeah.
You know, that covers most of my childhood and early manhood, watching City.
We talked a bit about Wolves. Wolves also had a man who won the Football of the Year, Bill Slater, who was centre-half. I don't know, was that after Wright retired? Or was that with Wright? Must have been with Wright for a stage.
They had four halfbacks who were interchangeable, given the...
Because Eddie Clamp
and Ron Flowers are the side of Slater and Wright. So when Wright went, Slater just took over completely. But he was a schoolmaster. I think he might have been an amateur originally.
Yes, I'm pretty sure he was. And his daughter went on to become BBC head of sport just recently. Retired.
Yeah, Barbara Slater, yes. Now, my recollection of Bill Slater, and he always used to come to the Football Writers' Dinners. He was very loyal to the Football Writers' Association, a wonderful gentleman. And he's listed as inside forward, left half, fullback. You remember him playing as a second centre-half, John. Mm. I remember him as a midfield player. I didn't realise he was that versatile. He also played fullback for Wolves. Mm. He could play anywhere. But great man, and I'm glad he's come up in the discussion.
Well, Arsenal in the 90s also had this plethora of centre-halves because they had Tony Adams as the one who couldn't be dropped, but they also had Martin Keown and they had Steve Bull.
And David O'Leary.
Now, he was a fantastic all-round player as well, David O'Leary.
From an early generation.
Yeah.
From the 80s.
At times, actually, George Graham would play all three centre-backs. He'd play a 3-5-2. I think he actually sealed one of his two titles by playing 3-5-2 in the last few games, which flummoxed the opposition or gave them an extra headache. Yeah, they were. I'm glad you brought up those centre-backs because they, Steve Bould in particular, would do something that nobody does these days, the near post corner, which was impossible to defend against. Mm-hmm. And Arsenal scored an awful lot of goals from Bould redirecting corners with a back flick.
One centre-back who we haven't mentioned, and I'm going to mention a Fulham player now. He was one of the great characters of the game. It was Bobby Keech, an extraordinary showman and player in the Johnny Haynes era. A great character throughout his life. I got to know him a wee bit after he retired, but he was an extraordinary player and much loved by Fulham fans of that era. Every side seemed to have a big... Skinner Normanton would have been a sort of centre-back type. Charlie Williams at Barnsley was a big centre-back.
Is this the bloke who was on The Comedian?
Yes.
But I don't remember him being very large. I kind of thought he was quite short.
No, he was quite big chap.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. The other one that people mentioned, and this is slightly before our era, as a very good ball-playing centre-back was a man called Leon Lutie.
Oh, yeah.
Who actually died prematurely, I think, of leukemia, was mentioned as a great footballing centre-back with Derby County when Derby County weren't a particularly good side. The other one I wanted to mention, Paddy, who came from Scotland, who played central defence, I believe, or you'll probably correct me now, was Bobby Evans, was tiny.
Yeah, oh God, you've hit the nail on the head there. Yes, he can't have been more than 5'7".
Maurice Setters also was not very big.
Yeah. That's right.
But he wasn't a centre-half. He was an aggressive winger.
He did play as a second centre-half for some of the time, actually, Colin.
Did he?
Yeah.
Although he could also play defensive midfield. He was a tough player, small but tough.
Yeah.
And I've got three players that I'm going to put in front of you. And they'd be, for me, candidates for the best uncapped English centre-half of all time. Would be Steve Bruce, Willie Madron of Middlesbrough, a magnificent player, one of the best centre-halves I've ever seen. Never got a cap. And a man called Joe Shaw, who made 700 league appearances.
Sheffield United.
He only played for Sheffield United. Now, did anybody see Joe Shaw?
I saw Joe Shaw play for Sheffield United. They had two players named Shaw in their side. They had Graham Shaw, a fullback, and Joe Shaw. And they were a side that played Leicester in the 1961 semi-final. Went to two replays before Leicester eventually won. Yes, he was a footballing centre-back and a gentleman seen as well. Sheffield United were quite a tough side. I think that was under John Harris as a manager.
One of the images that I think we all hold, and people much younger than us will share this, is Terry Butcher with the bandage.
Stockholm.
If a right winger had managed to get his head kicked in and was running up and down the right wing with a bloody bandage, it kind of wouldn't have quite the same mythic quality, I don't think, than a centre-half with a bloodied bandage. It's like Horatius at the bridge. I mean, it's like a heroic last defence, isn't it? If it's the centre-half who gets it, rather than a rather skillful little right-winger who gets a bloodied bandage.
Centre-backs play with two broken legs and a broken arm, don't they?
Yeah.
And I think that does come from that Butcher appearance.
Why did he become so iconic? Was it simply because we had to not lose to get into the World Cup final?
Yeah, he had to head all the crosses away, regardless of a widening gash. Also, the picture that was taken of him became more iconic because his eyes were wide open at the time.
Yes.
Do you remember when the West Indies fast bowlers, the quartet, peppered Brian Close? And Brian Close, deliberately not wearing any protective helmet or indeed padding, turned his shoulders on these missiles which rammed into his rib cage or his head, or, you know, a little bit like the Black Knight in the Monty Python film, you know, where his arms and his legs, everything gets cut off and his severed head is still saying, come on, if you're hard enough, you know.
There was also the fearsome George Curtis, who was Mr. Coventry City.
Yeah, he
used
was,
that
yeah,
phrase.
Yeah.
Went up from the fourth division to the first division with them. Then, wonderfully, was joint manager with John Sillett when they won the Cup.
Yes, he was.
He was a fearsome character, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He was all muscle.
Yeah.
He had a crew cut. You know, he could have been the most frightening sergeant major.
David Fairholme, our regular listener, or certainly our regular correspondent, wrote to us saying, the man with the shortest name in the top division of the English Football League was a Scottish centre-half called Ian Ure. Ian Ure must have been somebody that you must have seen quite a lot of.
I'm very happy to talk about that. Another converted midfield player. Ian Ure was recruited from Ayrshire to Dundee in the very, very late 1950s and turned out to be the rock on which our 1961-2 title season, our only title season, was built. We then got to the semi-finals of the European Cup, and Ian was regarded as one of the best centre-halves in Europe. Don't take my opinion for that. It was remarked upon by the managers of Anderlecht and others after games. He played with his, as some footballers did, he played with his shorts rolled up to make his thighs look even more intimidating, and he did have huge thighs.
Not a notable success when he went to Arsenal, though, was he?
When he was at Arsenal and later Manchester United, when people were saying, why have we bought this guy, you know, his knee had gone. It was during the Billy Wright period as manager. And clubs in those days, the medical departments were a joke. And eventually, when this knee condition was finally diagnosed, they gave him some pills to deaden the pain. And Ian later found out that these pills, which are now banned, were being used by unscrupulous racehorse trainers to deaden the pain in the horse's joints. So they were giving him animal medicine, but yet he still played well enough for Matt Busby to take him from Arsenal to Man United as the replacement for Billy Foulkes, because he wanted a real hard man. And Ian had got involved in a punch-up with Dennis Law, which was...
not difficult to do.
Not difficult at all. I once saw Alan Oakes, the most phlegmatic footballer. We just referred to him. I once saw him running at Dennis Law. They had a fist fight in a derby, and I think Alan Oakes wanted to kill him. And this is the most imperturbable footballer of all time. But apparently Ian had a fight, and Busby, when Ian refused to take any nonsense from Dennis Law, that's why they decided to buy him. However, his medical... when he went to Man United, he was told, lie down. And he was thinking, I'm definitely going to fail this because, you know, I've been taking all these drugs and my knee's shot. And the physio bent his leg to 90 degrees, murmured that it was okay, bent his other leg to 90 degrees and said, yeah, that's fine, he's okay.
Here's a quick question for Gary via John, which is, did Gary ever say which centre-half, central defender he hated playing against most? Because I would imagine it was somebody who was actually much more mobile rather than the old-fashioned...
Well, Des Walker and Alan Hansen would probably rate as the best. There was this story before Spurs played Nottingham Forest in the 91 final. Spurs played Forest in a league game. I watched that game and felt to me that Gary would played slightly sluggishly. I said to him afterwards, were you completely all right? And he said, it's a plan. He said, I played with the centre-half with Des Walker. Who's the centre-half? Young Nottingham lad.
Not Steve Chettle.
Oh, yes, it could have been Chettle. And he said, the idea was that we wanted Chettle to look as though he could hold me at centre-half, rather, which gave Walker rein on Spurs' other attackers. And the 91 Cup final, they did play Chettle on Lineker. And in the first 15 minutes, he scored once, incorrectly ruled as offside, and brought Gary down for a penalty, which actually was saved. And at which point, Clough changed it. Clough worked out that this Venables plan to make Chettle look quick enough to hold Lineker had failed, and he switched Des Walker around to play it.
In the late 60s, there was this move we've talked about slightly to the double centre-half or the twin central defenders, the Bobby Moore, Jack Charlton and so on. But it happens remarkably quickly. And all the clubs seem to follow a kind of lemming-like process of following exactly what the others had achieved. It always occurred to me that if they're all going to do the same thing, wouldn't it be cleverer to stick to the previous plan in which they weren't going to mark each other out of the game, and you could do something different? I mean, does every single tactical change automatically mean that the side who's adopted it is going to be a better team for it?
The answer is, I suppose, that this is fashionable. At the moment, every side, it seems to me, at almost all levels, are trying to play out of the back, a la Pep Guardiola, Manchester City. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it works when you've got the players of Manchester City's ability, but if the players are of less ability, it leads to more goals. We've now got the goalkeeper as a sweeper and becoming the third or fourth or fifth defender. And that seems to me to be part of the system. And as I say, in many ways, we've then gone back to the old system of three at the back, two wingers, a centre forward and two inside forwards and wing half in front of them. So evolution, but they go round, don't they?
They do.
People have talked to me about this inverted fullback as if it's something new. I watched David Nish do that. David Nish, who played mostly left back. He played left back for Leicester and he played left back for Derby County, doing that a lot of the time. There was that one occasion where Nish for Derby played a ball over the top of a advanced front line and was given offside when he chased his own pass or something. It was a bizarre innovation, but it's nothing new. Most of these things go round.
I suppose what I'm heading for, Paddy, is whether a team that was sufficiently brave enough to play a forward line, in the old-fashioned sense of the word, and a single centre-half, could have any impact against the however modern teams utilise their 10 outfield players? Would they just be wiped off the face of the earth, or would they have a chance?
Well, you certainly see it in the last 10 minutes of a game. I mean, there's always the argument, you know, about the long ball. Of course you play the long ball in the last 10 minutes of the game because that's what the crowd wants you to do, and that's what... Yeah, I wouldn't do it if it was a coach, but I've never seen the argument against scoring first. You know, why not panic in the first 10 minutes rather than the last? But anyway, that's by the by. I think you could play bravely like that. You could play a 3-2-5, but you'd get outnumbered, obviously, in the midfield.
In midfield.
So that would pull two of your men back for a start. You generally get matchups. I've never been able to understand how in the Premier League the managers all seem to know what formation the opposition will play. It makes you wonder whether they actually get together before a game.
No, but they frequently, mostly when they lose, they say, we were taken by surprise by their formation.
They're often taken by surprise early in the second half. That's true. But the usual post-match question is, you know, they came at us in the first 10 minutes, but we expected that.
I do remember with actually some glee in a funny sort of way, though we lost the game. In the European Cup final, which we lost against Chelsea 1-0, 10 minutes from time, Guardiola's brilliant chap at Manchester City was reduced to sending the big lad up front and huge long throw-ins from Kyle Walker into the penalty area to get the big lad to get his head on it. And it seemed to me we'd gone back to 1962 with the nonsense that was going on. And yet, you know, quite frankly, that's what the crowd wanted. And that was, seemed to be the best way of actually equalising, was get the ball in the penalty area and get the big lad up on the end of it.
Best centre-back of all time? Can we have a quick round of that? Of any nationality, of any type?
Well, Beckenbauer.
That was where I was going.
The Italian.
Fichetti?
No.
Baresi?
Baresi. Yes. Yeah.
There was Cannavaro.
Cannavaro was pretty good.
They had a libero, a Beckenbauer-type player in Italy who died young in a car crash called Gaetano Scirea, who I think won the World Cup with Italy. And he was a magnificent footballer. The one that never gets any mentions in all-time lists. You'll think I'm showing off here. I'm trying to be clever.
Not for the first time.
There was a centre-half who played in a very good Norway team that beat you English, to my intense joy, during Graham Taylor's time. His name was Rune Bratseth, and he spent most of his career with Werder Bremen. So he largely goes under the radar, but I don't think I've seen many better centre-halves than him. He was the Erling Haaland of centre-halves. Wonderful player. And you would never notice him on the field because he would just be robbing the centre-forward, taking it off his toes, and that's it.
I think United's triumphs in the, you know, the 2005-2012 era, I think a lot of that came from Ferguson's brilliant pairing of Vidic and Ferdinand. I do think that, they were both clever centre-halves and very difficult to get past. And United kept, you know, scored once. That's all you needed. Yeah. They would keep them out.
Paolo Maldini gave one of the best centre-back performances I've ever seen in the, I think it was 1994 Champions League final. Although a left-back, moved to centre-back for the final against Barcelona and just was majestic.
Well, I think we should mention the greatest team of all time because it's the one we all agree on.
Yeah.
And who knows who the centre-half was in the Brazil team that won the 1970 World Cup?
Santos, was it not?
No, I think it was Wilson Piazza. And I think that the second centre-half was Clodoaldo, who began the move that led to the fourth, the iconic fourth goal.
Carlos Alberto's goal.
Yeah. When you said the greatest team of all time, I immediately thought of Guardiola's Barcelona and Gerard Pique and Carlos Puyol.
Yes, Carlos Puyol, yeah.
Yes.
Who didn't play football until he was about 18.
What did he do before that?
He just messed around. He came from a village high in the mountains.
Catalan mountains.
Yeah.
Well, again, gentlemen, Paddy and John, thank you. And to our indefatigable producer, Paul Kovrak, thank you. We've come to the end of another rambling discussion that's not changed the world one iota. There is still war, terror and famine going on, and we haven't done anything to stop it, unfortunately. But for everybody who has been listening and wants to tell us how terrible we are, or alternatively how much they've enjoyed the programmes, you can write to us at footballruinmylife@gmail.com. So this is Colin Schindler saying thank you for listening. We'll see you all next time on another edition of Football Ruined My Life. Cheerio.
As mine recorded, Paul, can I sign off?
Whoops.
Paul's now disappeared with the recording.
He's gone offline. His internet has collapsed.
Oh, God. I don't want to click off then. I don't want to lose it.